ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today it's my conversation with the late John Marsden. John was a beloved children's author and a visionary educator who started his own school called Candlebark in Victoria. I spoke with John in 2018. John Marsden was a high school English teacher when he wrote his first novel, So Much to Tell You. John's writing took teenagers seriously, and right from that first book, they loved his novels. Tomorrow When the War Began was the start of a series of books that imagined the invasion of Australia, resisted by a small band of teenagers waging guerrilla war. Long before the Hunger Games, John made young people the heroes of stories that had real consequences. But even as he became an internationally best-selling author, John never lost his love for teaching. In 1998, he bought a giant swag of natural bush on the northern edge of Melbourne and eventually started his own school there called Candlebark. It's a school that John's described as somewhere between Steiner and The Simpsons. Hi, John.
G'day, Sarah.
What works about that combination, Steiner and The Simpsons?
Well, I shouldn't take too literally. I think I like the subversiveness of The Simpsons and the way that it causes you to challenge or question almost every aspect of society. But I also like the fact that Steiner was on about being reflective and about big issues and profound thinking. There's stuff about the Steiner system I don't like and stuff about The Simpsons I don't like. But between the two, there's some sort of worthwhile area to explore, I think.
Let's go back into your childhood. What's your earliest memory, John? What comes to mind?
Well, this is embarrassing, being toilet trained. I remember sitting on the toilet and screaming in terror, thinking I was going to fall in. And I could hear my father and siblings playing outside. So the toilet must have been in the backyard in the traditional manner. And I think I was angry that they were having a good time while I was about to drop into this bottomless pit of darkness. Didn't smell good either.
So who else was in your family? How many siblings do you have?
Three others, yeah. A boy? Well, I can't say a boy anymore. He's nearly 70. Two sisters and one brother.
You spent some of your time growing up in Devonport in Tasmania. What was that like as a place for you?
It was idyllic for a kid. I mean, we just wandered and explored and adventured all day long. There was a ferry you could catch across the river and go to North Devonport, which we did quite often. We loved the town tip. That was always a great playground.
The town tip?
Yeah, absolutely.
What would you find?
Oh, just anything from old stoves to debris, broken things, broken plates. If they weren't broken, we'd break them. Or if they were broken already, we'd break them again. And we'd go through the bush, we'd go through the town, just... And the library was small, but it was my kind of safe place, I guess.
How much time would you spend at the local library?
Sounds a bit like self-aggrandisement, but I'd go down after school and borrow three books, which was the maximum allowed, two fiction and one non-fiction, and because rules were strict in those days, and take them home and try to read them before the library closed at whatever, 6 p.m. or something.
What, read those three books?
Yep, and then race back and get three more. So I was an avid reader.
And what were you getting from those books? Was it a kind of a competition if you were trying to get them read, or
was the fear that I wouldn't have anything to read after about 9 o'clock if I didn't get three more books. It was an escape. It was disappearing into a different world. And so everyone from Enid Blyton to Nan Chauncey to Geoffrey Treece, mostly British writers with quite a lot of Australian and a few American. And not much else. There was a few European novelists I read, but it was just going into a world where things were so different and I felt completely detached from reality, which seemed to be desirable to me.
Why? What was reality like at home?
It was a bit grim, I have to say. I don't want to defame my parents after their deaths, but they were themselves... I suppose they mirrored what their parents had done. So my father had a tyrannical father, and I guess that made him quite a severe person himself. And my mother had a very manipulative and really quite negative mother, and I think she echoed some of those behaviours herself. So although they did their best as parents, they were forever changed by their own childhood experiences. This is my best guess anyway. And that then meant that they weren't, it wasn't a very safe house to be in.
As a kid, did you feel that your parents were interested in you, interested, say, in your love of reading?
No, they were interested in our achievements, which had to be of the highest order. And they were extremely critical of us at home, but very angry if anyone criticised us outside the home. So if we got a bad school report, they'd be angry at the teacher and angry at us. It created conflict and tension, which meant that by the start of adolescence or early in my adolescence, I stopped being the conformist child who was trying to achieve the highest possible standards in order to satisfy the unsatisfiable parents. And I became the rebel and went to the other extreme and started listening to Bob Dylan, God help me. that was the beginning of the end. I do remember the first time I heard a Bob Dylan song. It was lent to me by an amazing guy called Rob Bilby, who I was at school with, and it was Mr. Tambourine Man. And from the first notes and the first syllables of that voice, I was transfixed and transformed. And I remember almost consciously thinking, is this legal? Are you allowed to do this? It just sounded like something so much the voice of the outlaw that I couldn't believe you were allowed to do it. And reading The Catcher in the Rye had the same effect on me. I was like, God, this isn't Thomas Hardy. This seems like our voice. And that seemed extraordinary to me that you could express that voice openly and publicly and even get paid and recognised for doing it.
You're right. In Dylan's voice, there's so much attitude, isn't there? There's an identity in that voice. There's a message that's coming across, regardless of what he's singing. There's a posture there.
Yeah, it's like he's torn up the rule book, even though he knows the rule book. I was talking at a conference organised by Griffith University about creativity and saying to teachers who were at the conference that as a teacher you need to teach kids what's in the rule book but also teach them to tear it up and how to tear it up and when to tear it up. And Dylan, he knows music as well as anybody. He's got an extraordinary knowledge of folk music and blues and gospel, but he's chosen to go his own way. But nevertheless, you can see the elements of those influences in his work.
Why did your family leave Tasmania, John?
My father was a bank manager, and they had an inflexible policy that every 4 years people were transferred. And the way you'd find out that you were transferred was to get the fortnightly staff bulletin, and the last perhaps 4 or 5 pages was a list of the transfers for this fortnight. So you'd look up the list, and if your name was on it, you'd ring your partner and say, start packing, we're off to Kalgoorlie or Devonport or Brisbane or whatever. Yep, that's the way the system worked.
Do you remember how you felt about moving from Devonport to Sydney?
I was torn. I was excited about the big smoke going to the big city, but also, yeah, had very strong feelings about leaving my friends and just walking away from a place where I'd just gradually established my own kind of territories and did feel safe when I was roaming around the countryside and the town.
What was the drive up to Sydney like?
It was a marathon. It was we took 2 nights staying in Goulburn and I can't remember the other place along the way, Albury. And, it was a massive road trip to us and it was hot. It was January. And then we came to Sydney and it was just mind-boggling to go through suburb after suburb after suburb. And being a car from Tasmania with Tasmanian number plates made us an instant object of curiosity. And so crowds would gather when we stopped anywhere or when people would point to the car and look at it with amazement as we drove around the city or the suburbs. Because I saw one other car from Tasmania during those early months before we got the number plates changed.
Once you got to Sydney, John, where did you go to school?
Well, I started at Castle Hill Primary and then went to Eastwood Primary and then ended up at the King's School, which is, for people who don't know it, an all-boys school, Anglican, very conservative with a military bent, military philosophy or ideology. We had to wear military uniforms all day, every day, and a lot of marching and saluting.
Who did you have to salute?
Our teachers, if we met them down the street or if anyone stopped to let us cross the road, we had to salute the driver of the car. We had to stand to attention when we spoke to prefects. Yeah, it was all done along Victorian lines. And I mean Queen Victoria, not the state of Victoria. But it was pretty anachronistic.
As a bookish kid or a kid into Dylan and into Catcher in the Rye, how did you find this environment?
There was a small number of teachers who were quite liberal and I guess I could use a word that's not used much in Australia and said that they were intellectuals, and they were the people who kind of kept me sane, but they were in a minority and I don't know how they survived because it was a pretty rigid and authoritarian atmosphere, and I copped it big time because it was, as I was saying earlier, the start of my kind of adolescent rebellion against parents, and that rebellion extended to the school and to the universe, really. I remember this moment. I don't know whether this is common, but I was 14. I was standing outside my lockers after school one afternoon, and I could take you to the spot today if you had time. And there was a kind of lightning strike through my brain, and I suddenly thought, what if my parents aren't perfect? And what if the school isn't right in all these rules and regulations? And what if there is no God? And what if all the politicians are not telling the truth? And this all happened in the space of, it seems to me, I don't know, 8 seconds. And it was like a lightning bolt, an earthquake. The world was turned upside down, to mix my metaphors, and I was never the same again. I just, from then on, I questioned everything and challenged everything and started to see that appearances did not tell the truth and that there were other worlds which were difficult to find sometimes, let alone explore, but it was very worthwhile to try to get inside them.
It's amazing that you can remember that in a road to Damascus moment. Were there other kids that you kind of had a shared sensibility with that you talked to this stuff about?
Yeah. Kings had a little prep school up at Moss Vale called Tudor House, which was a very idiosyncratic school. And the students from there did their first year of secondary school at Tudor House and then came on to Kings in year eight. And they were quirky, funny, engaging, and challenged everything and rebelled happily at every opportunity. And I found a great kinship with that group. And again, they helped keep me sane too. Well, not that I was particularly sane, but it was a lifeline, really.
Did that moment feel liberating or terrifying?
Both, but probably certainly terrifying. I wouldn't say liberating, but just incredibly powerful. I just sort of felt that I was now in a state of chaos or a limbo, and I didn't know what was true anymore. I mean, Kings was very good, and what I say about Kings now refers to 1968. I'm sure it's a very different school in 2018, but it was very good at appearances, and so the school looked wonderful, the campus looked beautiful, the buildings were spectacular, and the sight of us parading around all day was apparently impressive. And yes, it was more like the Heart of Darkness. There was a tremendous amount of violence and bullying. And I think that was very important for me to realise that Western society was too much into illusion and appearances.
You had a letter published in the school magazine in 1967. John, tell me about it.
I wrote a letter just challenging the idea that the prefects should have so much power. It's that old adage which applies to anyone in a position of authority. Are you yourself honourable enough, to use an old-fashioned word, to tell other people how to behave and to punish them when they don't behave according to your criteria? So there were prefects who were obviously corrupt and were spectacularly corrupt, and usually in the way in which they exercised their power, which was violently. So I wrote a letter just suggesting that this wasn't a very good system, which caused outrage among some and delight among others, I guess.
What was expected of you after finishing school?
Well, I think just to follow the traditional career path. And so I got into arts law at Sydney University and didn't really think twice about doing that course. I'd had little interest in science or maths through my secondary schooling, and I have to say that's largely due to inadequate teaching. I think that's a fair and objective comment. The science department in particular was really weak. And I don't know how you can make science boring, but they managed to do it. And so that meant that very few paths were open to me, and going to university was definitely expected. So I signed up, but I was just lost at university. It was I think there were 23,000 students there in that era. And the psychology lectures I remember in particular, because there were just giant video screens all through this massive auditorium. And the lecturer was sort of a distant figure at the front of the hall. And so you'd watch the video screens. So the whole thing was incredibly impersonal.
What about, though, all that freedom and that meaning that you were wanting or hungering after as a high school student? Wouldn't that have been everywhere on the campus in the late 60s?
It possibly was, but I'd gone badly off the rails. But then by January, I'd had enough of life at home, and I did the traditional thing of leaving a note on the pillow and nicking off at... it was meant to be at 3 o'clock in the morning, and a friend was going to pick me up by stealing his mother's car, but he didn't arrive, and luckily I had a plan B, which was a taxi driver who had heard me talking about my plans one day when I was with a mate in the back of his cab, and he said over his shoulder, "Oh, you're doing a midnight flit," and I didn't even know what that meant, but sort of gave an evasive or ambiguous answer, and he said, "Oh, you know, I'll come and pick you up for, I can't remember now whether it was $20 or $50, anytime, 24/7, just ring this number."
So he was a sympathetic soul.
Yeah, well, he was. As it turned out, I wasn't sure what his motives were, but I rang the number at about 5 a.m. and he came burning out to Parramatta so fast that his radiator boiled, and we had to wait a while till it calmed down, and then took off again. Luckily,
where were you going? Where did he take you?
Well, I'd found a room in King's Cross. This sounds incredibly sordid and unlikely, but it's all true. I'd been checking out rooms via estate agents, just little rental bed sitters, and I noticed that the window in one was open at the top to allow ventilation, and it was on ground level in Kellett Street. And I thought, gee, I could come in through that window and get into this place. And I just gambled that it would still be empty when I arrived with my few meagre possessions. So a couple of days later, that's what I did. It was the Australia Day weekend. It was a public holiday. So Monday morning, we arrived at this place, and luckily the window was still open. So I said to the taxi driver, "Oh, I've lost my key. I'll go in through the window," and let myself in through the door. And I squatted in there for a few weeks until I had enough money to pay the rent, and then went back to the real estate agent and said, "I want to rent that room that you showed me a few weeks ago." And they asked for the rent in advance, which I had, so that was fine. And then they asked for something called a bond. And I said, "What's a bond?" And they said, "Well, it's what you..." And they explained what it was. And I was just dumbfounded because I didn't have any more money. And I guess this wouldn't happen now, but the two women there looked at each other, and one said to the other, "He seems like a nice boy." The other one agreed, and they decided that I wouldn't have to pay a bond. So I moved in legally. And,
I hope you took very good care of that room.
I did, actually. Good. I didn't do anything to damage it at all. I vacuumed it occasionally even. And I was there for about 8 months, I think.
Did you have any contact with your parents, or you just left a note on the pillow?
Yep. Yeah, I had friends whose families, three friends in particular, whose parents helped me in different ways. One gave me a whole lot of crockery and cutlery and cooking stuff, and one lent me $50, and the other one helped me find a job. So, yeah, that was a big factor.
And so when you were there at Sydney Uni and feeling overwhelmed by the numbers and the impersonality of it, I guess, were you seeing a kind of future for yourself when you looked around at the other students, the people who were there? What did it look like?
Yeah, I didn't really think about that much. I was mainly interested in earning money to keep myself afloat. And so I had a mantra, which was take any job you're offered. And so at times I was working three different jobs, cleaning job on weeknights, working at Sydney Hospital on weekends, and just picking up casual work occasionally as well. So I wasn't giving much time or effort to study. And the time came when I'd actually, some couple of years down the track, I'd got as far as a second year law, and I'd landed articles with a very good firm. But towards the end of second year, I was in the cafeteria at the law school in Phillip Street, and the final year students were all coming in for their evening classes, and they were all doing articles, so an apprenticeship effectively. And they all had these grey pinstripe suits, three-piece suits. And I just saw this army of pinstripe-suited men, mostly, coming through the doors of the cafe, and I thought, I can't do this. It's just, I can't join that army. And I got up and left and went back a couple of days later to clear out my locker, but that was the last time I entered the doors, the hallowed doors of the law school.
How were things going for you emotionally at this time, John?
Oh, badly, as you'd expect. I ended up in a psych hospital for about 6 weeks, I think.
What was going on to end up in a psych ward?
I was desperate and I was suicidal. And I thought, in a very rational way, I haven't ever seen a psychiatrist. And I think psychiatry sounds like a load of bunkum. And I'd seen American comedies about psychiatrists, which made them all sound like seem like nutcases. But I thought it'd be pretty silly to kill myself without at least trying this path, because obviously you must have something to offer. And so I went and saw one, and I think that was the turning point, really. I think what I learned in that hospital was immensely valuable, and although it was a painful time, it was also a time of discovery. And so I'm very grateful to the staff there. It was a positive experience.
When you took that, you know, very courageous and smart decision to check into a hospital, could you name what you were feeling? Could you even have the language to talk about what you were experiencing?
No, and it was something that slowly dawned on me while I was in there, that I didn't have the language of emotions. I look back on that and think how weird that is, but it was true that they'd get me to talk about things that had happened to me and I'd do that. And then they'd say, but how did you feel when that happened? And I'd just look at them completely unable to answer and look at them quizzically and say, what do you mean? How did I feel? And they'd say, well, you must have felt something. And I'd think, God, I don't know what I felt. And I had to develop, I had to learn a vocabulary for feelings. I was 19 when this was going on, and it's a bit late to be learning those words, but that's essentially what happened. And that's stood me in good stead since, I think. I learnt a lot there about honesty and emotions.
How do you go about learning that language if you haven't learned it from your family or your teachers?
Well, I guess because they were good at their job and they kept probing and saying, and they'd prompt me, they'd say, you know, did you feel anger? And I'd think, yeah, I guess I did, yeah. And I remembered, for example, looking into a mirror when I was about 9 and using all the bad words I could think of against my parents, who weren't in the room at the time, of course, but I was saying them out loud to the mirror, that you are beep, beep, beep. And I was a bit horrified at that age that I was doing it, and I didn't know why I was doing it. But when I looked back at that at the age of 19, I could see that, yeah, that's anger. So it was just recalling all the aspects of those experiences, I guess.
Was there one therapist or one psychiatrist in particular that you made a connection with?
Yeah, there was a young social worker there. They had a team to look after each patient. And so there'd be the psychiatrist and the psychiatric registrar and a couple of nurses and so on, and the social worker. And something about this social worker meant that about her ability to listen and respond seemed to work for me. So I asked if I could sort of make her the person I talked to most. And then when I was discharged, I kept seeing her, and she became a psychotherapist, a psychoanalytical psychotherapist. I'm not even sure what that means, even to this day. But I kept seeing her intermittently for 40 years. She moved to Melbourne eventually, and later I moved to Victoria and resumed the connection. So that became, yeah, an extremely long relationship, obviously, which meant that I was seeing her for many years. It was 5 days a week, sometimes 4 days a week or 3 during other periods, depending on which decade you're talking about. Yeah, until she retired, that was an incredibly important relationship.
What was it about the way that she listened to you that was so helpful?
She never gave me advice, and she never talked about herself, and she was completely scrupulous and honest and ethical in every respect. I'd never met anyone like that, but I sort of needed that. I needed someone objective, because I'd been surrounded by people who were emotionally very caught up in their own lives, and I didn't want to take on someone else's emotions again. It was too taxing.
So what was it like when she retired?
She gave me plenty of warning, and we said it meant that we could sort of prepare for it. But, yeah, I was very tearful for the last couple of sessions, and I still... if she went back into business tomorrow, I'd be there on the doorstep. So it was life-sustaining. I think without that, I think I probably would have ended up taking my own life, to be blunt. I was pretty desperate. So I'm very grateful to her. But, yeah, there's no magic cure. I don't think that I'm now, you know, a completely happy, healthy, fulfilled person. I'm not sure that anyone is. But it's a lot to ask for or hope for. But it has given me strength to cope with crises and to deal with difficult situations. And running a school, you certainly need some sort of inner strength.
Well, how did teaching enter the picture?
Partly for negative reasons. I think I was so angry at the schooling that I'd been subjected to. I mean, in 13 years, I'd had two inspiring teachers and another one who was pretty good, but I wouldn't say inspiring. And the rest varied from mediocre to just appalling. And really, for 13 years, that's not much. And yet, people I meet nowadays, young people nowadays, seem to have a similar strike rate. So I don't think anything much has changed. So I was angry about the way I was taught. I felt that it could be done better. And having dropped out of four university courses, which you could do in those days, in 5 years, I'd lost all confidence. So I thought I'd choose the easiest tertiary course that I could find. If I failed that or dropped out of that, that would prove to me that I was a completely useless student. So I chose a primary teaching course at a country CAE because I figured you can't get anything easier. And I've got to say, from the first day, I was utterly energised and excited by the course because they were quite overtly teaching us to be subversive. And they were saying, get out there and change the system and don't accept the practices and traditions that you'll find, but instead turn them upside down and, change everything.
So, John, when you began your teaching degree and found it invigorating and exciting, you then moved out into actual teaching in a school. How did that compare?
It was good in many ways. It was a school at Bathurst in New South Wales, All Saints College, and they'd had an extraordinary few years under the leadership of a guy called Peter Gebhardt, who later went on to run Geelong College in Victoria. And I think he was appointed principal at 28 or some extraordinary age like that. But he gathered around him the most exciting group of teachers that anyone could possibly find, and the place just took off as far as cultural and spiritual and artistic and aesthetic kind of issues went. And I unfortunately just missed that because he'd left and a new person had come, a very conservative person. But so many of his staff remained that it was a really exciting place to work. And I learned more about teaching from those colleagues in those first couple of years than I have ever done before or since.
How big a part was sport of that school culture?
Oh, yeah, it was. I was the sportsmaster for the first year.
You were the sportsmaster?
I was.
Were you well qualified for that role?
Not at all, but I was desperate to get a job and I tried to make myself... I'd been getting a free board in exchange for helping supervise boarders and coach sporting teams and so on while I did my university course, or my CAE course. And so I already was at the school for 2 years before I got a job there. And I could see that unemployment in teaching was a problem, so I decided to make myself indispensable so that they'd offer me a job. And they did, but the only vacancy they had was sportsmaster and PE teacher. So there I was. And, I mean, when I was at King's, they ranked rugby teams by ability, and rugby was compulsory, but you could be in the under-16 A's, B's, C's, all the way down to H's. I was reserved for the H's for my whole school career. So to end up as a sportsmaster was... certainly something paradoxical, but I quite enjoyed it. And then gradually I got to teach more and more English and enjoyed that even more, I'd have to say.
When did you first have the idea of starting your own school? Was it way back then?
Yeah, absolutely, in about my first or second year of teaching in Bathurst. I put an ad in the Sydney Morning Herald and we got about 18 or 20 replies from people who were interested, but it wasn't enough and we didn't have any money or location or anything. There's a couple of teachers at All Saints and I who put the ad in. And it was certainly enough to whet my interest and to make me think, yeah, there is a response that's possible to generate for something like this. But I didn't try again until many years later, the mid-80s, when I tried for Wagga. And I'd, in a very rational way, picked Wagga as the 17th biggest city in Australia and the highest one on the list that didn't have an independent school. So that's the only criterion that I used. And again, it fizzled out. We got much closer. I made the decision then that the only way to do it was to get enough money to do it yourself without having to go around sort of with cap in hand begging for money and trying to squeeze a dollar here and a dollar there. And I thought, if the day ever comes when I get enough money to do it myself, I'll do it, but otherwise it's just a waste of time and energy.
So did you start writing fiction as a way to make money?
No, I don't think that was I bought lottery tickets, but that didn't work, funnily enough. I don't think that was connected. Writing was something I'd always done and loved, and it was just my creative outlet.
When you started, though, writing the book that led to being published, your first novel, did you have a particular reader in mind, or what were you trying to do with that book?
I just wanted to write something that modern adolescents would respond to, because having studied Thomas Hardy at school and other writers like him, the society had changed, but the literature hadn't. And although a couple of American writers were just emerging who wrote for teenagers, it was an unknown field, an unknown genre. But I read those American writers, Paul Zindel and Judy Blume, and I thought, these guys are onto something. And then at about the same time, the Year 9 students started asking me for books that I could recommend. And I went into the school library and combed the shelves and came out empty-handed and feeling very depressed and feeling that I'd failed them. And I thought, bugger this, I'll write one myself. And so I did write So Much to Tell You and gave it to 6 students to read, and they all responded positively. One girl wept as she talked about the effect that it had on her. And I don't know, maybe she just wanted an A in English or something, but she seemed very sincere, and I was very moved by her response. And so I kept going.
What was it about the way that you were writing that you think connected with those 6 readers and then all the readers after? Was it different language? Was it the story? What was it that you were doing?
Well, it was certainly different language and different story. I had in mind that adage of W.H. Auden's that you should marry the highbrow with the lowbrow. So I wanted to write a story that would be accessible and engaging, but at the same time have more profound, I don't know, depth to it than Enid Blyton, God rest her soul. And I think you said in your introduction something about treating young people as important. I totally respect their feelings and their thoughts. So if they fall in love, I'm not going to mock it or make condescending comments about puppy love or tell them, oh, yes, we all, you know, get our heart broken when we're 14. It's the love that you feel at any age is intense and incomparable. And I respect that, whether it's a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 50-year-old.
What did you understand teenagers to be interested in, to care about, from your experience with them as a teacher?
Relationships and the world. They're at that age where they still have the egoism of young children in that they are concerned about their own lives and so on, but they also can take a global perspective, and so they're deeply interested in the environment and issues like that. Many of them are interested in politics, many of them are interested in history and philosophy. So we are pretty patronising in the way we treat them. Like, I've been to schools where they set Roald Dahl books for Year 7 or 8 students, and I really admire Roald Dahl's books, but not for studying in a Year 7 or 8 English class. They're written for primary age children, and I think it's incredibly patronising to give them stuff like that in secondary school. When I teach Year 7 English, I start most years that I've done it. The very first lesson is Shakespeare. We dive straight into Hamlet because I want to give them a shock and realise, okay, we're in the big world now. But also they're ready for that. They can handle that and they can take on that challenge.
After your first novel, So Much to Tell You, was published, how quickly did you start hearing from readers?
Yeah, pretty quickly. It was kind of what you dream of as a writer, that people will write you these letters, and they were heartbreaking, many of them, teenagers writing about their lives and the difficulties they encountered. Some of those became quite long correspondences that went on for some years, including one with a girl who died essentially of psychological problems that she was experiencing. And, yeah, it was pretty heartrending stuff.
How did you know how to respond to those letters?
I guess just because I'd been through therapy myself, and so I wrote back in the same kind of style, really. I'd just respond sympathetically without getting mushy or emotional, but I'd make it clear that I was hearing what they were saying, that I took it seriously and regarded it as important, and that, yeah, it was not to be trivialised.
The Tomorrow series, John, which so many readers around the world have loved, is set in an Australia that's been invaded and occupied by a foreign power. And it's a small group of teenagers led by a teenage girl, Elia, waging war on enemy soldiers. What What drew you to that subject?
Well, I think growing up in the 1950s and 60s, post-war, I'd read so much about World War II. So The Naked Island by Russell Braddon was one of my Bibles when I was growing up. And reading it over and over again, the question that was always in my head was, what would I have done? Would I have been able to cope with that? Would I have pulled the trigger in those circumstances? Would I have run away or thrown myself on the ground and sobbed? Or would I have jumped out of a tree onto a Nazi's shoulders and throttled him? Those questions are unanswerable because they're all hypothetical for me. And I've been lucky in that way. But I think one of my motivating factors in writing a book is that I want to explore a question to which I won't ever get a complete answer, but by exploring the question, I'll get some insight. And so the question that was in my mind when I started writing those books was, how would today's teenagers cope if they were in that sort of situation? Because there was a commonly held view that today's teenagers are soft, they're weak, they're flabby, all they care about is computer games. And I thought, I wonder if that's the case. So I just wanted to put them into a stressful, extremely stressful situation and see what would happen next. And I had no idea when I started the book as to whether they would triumph or succumb, but I suppose I felt that some of them at least would come out of it.
The 10 novels, I think you wrote, featuring Ellie and her friends, is it hard to let go of those characters once you've put your pen down for the last one?
Not greatly. Not after 10. I sort of wound it up after 7. I really wound it up after 1, and then the next day started writing another one, so that didn't work. And then I thought I'd stop at 3, then it was 7. After 10, yeah, I felt that there was nothing more that I could say about them, that I'd explored their lives in every possible way, and yeah, I didn't feel so much regret.
In terms of kind of making peace with some of those inner demons, does writing help with that? Is it one of the ways that you wrestle with emotional or psychological stuff?
I don't think it does much. I mean, I know people often believe it does, but I don't think it has for me. Reading has. I read books which often stop me in my tracks and have me thinking for days. It might be just one sentence, and I'll think, wow, yeah, is that true for me? Is that true for the world? Is that true for whatever? Talking to people does, teaching does, but I don't think writing does in particular.
What does it do for you then? What need does it scratch?
It gives me the ability to explore, because I'm so sick of glib statements and one-liners and mottos and mantras and all the things stuck on people's fridges that they claim that are truths that they live by. I just find that incredibly meaningless and forgettable. So a book gives you a chance to really get into something in depth and to really understand it in its many aspects. I think it was Andre Gide who wrote that the colour of truth is always grey. So all of my books, I think you could say, do not present life or explore life as a black and white kind of subject. They're all about ambiguities and complexities.
Tell me then how you came to buy this land outside of Melbourne. I believe you had a conversation with some accountants.
I did. I'm embarrassed about it, really. But the books had done well, and I had ended up making a stack of money, which was not something that seems to happen often enough to writers. But the accountants eventually, there were three of them, a lawyer and two accountants, and they had a meeting with me and they said, look, you've got to spend some of this money. It's ridiculous.
And I dream of having meetings like that, well, John.
I just gazed at them blankly and said, well, what am I meant to spend it on? And they said, well, you know, I've got this friend who just flew first class to Fiji and had a fantastic 3 weeks, and why don't you do that? And I thought, well, I'm not really interested in doing that. And they said, oh, cars, you could buy cars. And I thought, well, I don't really care much about cars. So it all fizzled out, and I went away and thought about it, and I suddenly had this kind of flashback to when I was at King's and these graziers would come to pick up their kids, and they'd arrive in these utes that were covered with the brown dust of inland Australia, the brown dirt. And I loved, there was something incredibly romantic about that. And I had stayed on a few properties and loved the lifestyle and the whole landscape. And so I went back to the accountants and said, I want to buy a farm. And they looked at each other, and one of them said, that's a great tax deduction. And so obviously I'd satisfied their impulses. And so I went out looking for a farm. And as I did so, I thought, you know, if I was really smart, I'd buy a place which wasn't just a farm, but I could run writing courses, which was something I was really keen to do. So I found a place which was actually not a farm. It was native bush, 850 acres. And according to a real estate agent, the biggest privately owned native bush property in Victoria. And so I bid for it and got it and ran writing courses for 8 years on that property.
It had never been a farm.
There'd been a bloke who'd been a logger who'd lived in a little cottage there and had slowly cleared a few acres just back in the 19th century using an axe and whatever else. But apart from that, the rest of it's still in its virginal state.
When you say 850 acres, I don't really have a sense of how big that is. When did you get a sense of the size of what you'd bought?
Well, this is embarrassing too, because I didn't have any idea and I'd never seen the boundaries and I'd only seen probably 10% of the property at most. And after I'd been there some weeks, one of the accountants, they keep popping up, arrived in a four-wheel drive, which he'd just bought. And I said, great, let's go for a drive. So we started driving along this track through the property and we went further and further. And I thought, God, we must be on someone else's land. This is ridiculous. And we drove and drove and did this huge circle and came back to where we'd started. And I still had no idea how much of it was mine. And then a few months later, I met a bloke who was a sort of part-time map maker. And we were chatting away. And when I learned that he did maps, I said, are you interested in if I commission you to map my property? And he said, yeah. So he came and mapped the property. And when he gave me the map, then I knew where the property was and what the boundaries were. By then I'd been there, I don't know, 6 months at least. And I was stunned because I realised that when I drove with the accountant that day, we'd been on my land the whole time. And I call it my land, but it's very much just something that you take care of and then hand on.
So when you decided to set up a school on that land, John, what kind of school did you want to create?
I wanted first-hand experiences for students, for young people. I was getting so bored by conversations with teenagers who talked about nothing but what they'd seen on TV the night before that I thought there's something going badly amiss here and we need to put people back in touch with first-hand experiences. So to this day, 13 years later, that's what the school does very powerfully and very successfully, I'd have to say. So,
what kind of experiences? What do you mean?
Everything. We have kids going to on the Larapinta Trail next week. We've had kids going to WOMAD in Adelaide. Later in the year, we've got 45 kids going to France and Spain for 6 weeks. We've got canoe trips, ski trips, trips to the theatre, to the opera, to the ballet.
What you're describing were all trips away from the land. What happens actually in that enormous stretch of land?
They run and they climb trees and they ride bikes and they ride skateboards and they roll down hills and they chase each other and they play tag and they play stick wars and they sit under a tree and read a book or they play chess or they talk. It's not all wild activity, but anyone who comes to the school, I think, would notice the energy levels of the students are terrific. And we don't have a problem with childhood obesity. These are kids who look healthy and fit, and they are healthy and fit because that's the kind of space that we give them. And we don't have to stand there supervising and say, right, everybody, it's time for tag or it's time for stick wars or time for basketball. We just sit back and they just make it all up themselves.
Is the fact that those kids are in a natural setting, that they're around trees and animals, is that a big part of what you wanted?
It's a bonus. It's lucky, but it's not everything. And I don't think it's necessary at all. So you can have a terrific school in an inner city setting or in a suburban setting. You could have a school in a barn or in an attic, except you wouldn't be allowed now by the government because of all the strict regulations. But if I had an inner city school, then I'd be using all the parkland that I could get to. I'd be using excursions out to the country. We do two little things which are incredibly helpful. One is that when parents enrol their children, they sign a generic form saying that we can take their kids anywhere, anytime, without any further permission, so that we don't have to get all those tedious permission slips for everything we do. And we also have our own fleet of buses. We have 11 buses for 350 kids, and most of the teachers have licenses. So we can just say to a group, OK, hop in the bus, we're going to the gallery. And they don't need any further preparation than that. We just tell them to go to the toilet. before they get on the bus.
Is it a structured timetable, or what's a day like for a kid?
Yeah, on the face of it, it's very structured and very normal looking. So you might have double science followed by English, followed by PE, followed by art. But that timetable is varied frequently. So teachers know when they start work at the school that they have to be prepared to be flexible, that they might lose their class for 2 weeks running, but they might then be able to take their class on an excursion or a camp which goes for 3 days the next week. So it all ends up balancing out pretty well, I think. I think the flexibility helps the kids too, because they don't go crazy when there's an outing. And the teachers constantly say to me, it's such a pleasure to take them anywhere, because it's like just travelling with, you know, a group of your friends. They don't go mad because they're so used to it. They just recognise that that's their routine.
What kind of teachers are you looking for when you employ someone at Candlebark?
People who have lived adventurous lives, which can be physically adventurous. They might have canoed across Bass Strait or hitchhiked across Russia, or it can be creatively adventurous. They might have published their own book of poems, or they might have composed music for the Australian Ballet. It's just people who've lived life in an adventurous and creative way and have shown that they are not dull or humdrum or banal in their approach to life.
As principal, John, what's your approach to discipline?
Conversations, which can be very one-sided, as in don't ever do that again. Is that four words? No, it's a bit more. But they can go on for months, and they can be prolonged, and they can be pretty far-ranging. So it depends on the situation and the student. And we don't really have... I do suspend kids occasionally. I have expelled kids in the past. I don't know whether I'd do it again. I suppose I would if the circumstances arose, but it's pretty rare. A kid might be kept in occasionally to do some homework or to finish a piece of work from class, but there's no formal disciplinary process, and it's not a major element in the school's life. It's really just certain kids need a lot of attention from staff, and that usually consists of talking to them about their behaviour and how they can improve it and why they should improve it.
I guess that has as an assumption that kids want to get on with adults as well as their friends. Is that the kind of underlying, is that the starting point that you've got?
Yeah, I mean, no one sets out to be the naughtiest kid or the worst kid or to be destructive or damaging. I don't think it's anyone's ambition in life. If they come from a difficult background, then we can't fix every problem in their life, but we can gradually bring them to an awareness that school is a place which is different to the other experiences they've had in life, and that they will be treated with great courtesy, and that they will be treated with regard, and their feelings will be listened to and respected, even though at the same time we might be saying to them that their behaviour has to be changed. We can't allow them to damage other people or property in the way that they might have been doing.
You now also have a high school connected with Candlebark. What do you want kids to have when they finish their time at school? What do they need to be graduating with?
I want them to have access to whatever path they're interested in following. If they want to build a little cabin in the woods and live there, or if they want to go off to a third world country and help people, or if they want to do medicine at a prominent university, then whichever of those paths, or any one of a million other paths they want to follow, I want them to be able to follow that. And that takes not just the qualifications and the academic experience, it also takes a certain inner strength, which we try to develop. I'm interested in a genuine confidence, which is not spectacular or flamboyant. It's a strength which enables people to cope with everything that life throws at them. The Koreans have a saying, life is 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. And I think it's important, having said before I don't like glib statements, nevertheless, I think that's worth keeping in mind, because we try to pretend that we can somehow help our children navigate through a life where they don't ever experience sorrow. And that's ridiculous. They will experience many sorrows and many griefs. What we can do is give them the strength to cope with those griefs when they happen, rather than try to shield them from them.
How did you meet your wife, John?
Well, I called it a parent-teacher interview that went horribly wrong.
Or horribly right.
Well, yeah, it's been fantastic, actually. When I started teaching, I remember thinking, as I did parent-teacher interviews, if the day ever comes when I look at one of the mothers and think, wow, you're really hot, then I'll know I've been, I'm getting old. And that certainly happened. And so, yeah, we've been together 10 years and it's been wonderful. It's been a massive change in my life, but for the better. And we have not just a marriage, but a strong friendship. And I think one without the other is probably difficult to make work.
She had kids when you guys met.
Six of them.
Six sons.
Yeah, yeah. So that's been a massive change in my life too.
So you'd gone from knowing kids as students, from writing about kids as teenagers. What was the biggest shock, actually becoming dad to six sons?
I don't think there have been many shocks. It's been pretty good from my point of view. I hope they'd say the same. It's been pretty fantastic. We've laughed a lot. They're very funny and they're quick-witted and they're very physical, which I'm not particularly, but I've started playing backyard cricket and all that stuff. When Chris, my wife, told them that we were getting married, only two of them burst into tears. So I thought, that's not bad. Out of six, I'll settle for that. And in the years that have passed, they seem to have adjusted pretty well to the situation. Yeah, I think having all boys is perhaps easier than having a mixture.
The noise level in your place must have changed a lot when they moved in.
That's certainly, yeah, over the top. To the point where a couple of times lately I've pulled over in the road to have a nap on the way home because I know there's no hope of having one when I get home.
John, I think whether the kids are your kids or your students, they're very, very lucky to have you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah.
I spoke with John Marsden in 2018 and he died in 2024 at the age of 74. Candlebark, the primary school that John founded, and Alice Miller, the high school, are both in Victoria. This episode of Conversations was produced by Nicola Harrison and the executive producer was Pam O'Brien. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.